Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The New York Times revealed that the FBI has recently arrested an NSA contractor. Did the U.S. government thwart another Edward Snowden-type situation? This comes on the heels of news that hundreds of millions of Yahoo email accounts have been scanned using a custom-made software program in order to comply with the demands of the NSA and the U.S. government. Are we witnessing an unprecedented escalation in Syria? After the U.S. suspended communication with Russia earlier this week, military action against Damascus was back on the table at the White House and Pentagon yesterday. But is Obama likely to take such a drastic measure? The IMF and World Bank begin their annual meetings in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. But this year, an atmosphere of gloom hangs over them, and opposition to globalization rises and nationalist sentiments increases. What will policymakers do to try to accomplish their goals? But first, we turn to Bill Binney, William Binney, the NSA whistleblower. We're talking about the arrest by the FBI of another NSA contractor. Welcome back, Bill Binney.
Thanks for having me back.
Bill Binney, let me ask you, the New York Times broke the story that the FBI secretly arrested a National Security Agency contractor in recent weeks and is investigating whether this person stole and disclosed highly classified computer codes developed to hack into the networks of foreign governments, according to several law enforcement officials and intelligence officials who spoke to the New York Times. I want to read from the Times article. The theft raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, an insider has managed to steal highly damaging secret information from the NSA. In 2013, Edward Snowden, who was also a contractor for the agency, took a vast trove of documents that were later passed to journalists exposing NSA surveillance programs in the United States and abroad. Bill Binney, when you were on Loud and Clear the last time, when we were talking about the hacks that have taken place in recent months that, of course, the Democratic National Convention or committee asserted were the responsibility for Russia, you said at that time you thought there was a second Edward Snowden, a second insider, a second whistleblower, or someone who was working inside the NSA who is revealing information. Talk about it.
Yes. I mean, it appeared to me, because of the nature of the NSA network, it's almost impossible to hack in. At least I could not see how they could do it. So I assumed immediately that it was an insider. In the Tailored Access Office, that's where all that software came from that they use to hack into, you know, go through firewalls and hack into servers and switches and networks and be able, and not counting the Bull Run program type where they build weaknesses in the crypt systems. That's another issue. This was the hacking into, and I think it came from the Tailored Access Office of NSA. And that's the fact that he had the source code, which I didn't think they exposed to contractors. But I guess they're letting the contractors run that too. So I mean, that's why I assumed it was a second Edward Snowden to hack into foreign governments and so on. That's an outright lie. It's to hack into everybody. It's not. I mean, if you have an operating system that they got a weakness that they can penetrate it for everybody in the world that has it. And the same is true for firewalls and all of that. So if you've got weak switches or weak servers or whatever, wherever the weakness is in the network, those tools will work anywhere in the world.
Yeah. So what you're saying, I think, is that the presentation that these codes or these weaknesses that are built into the systems to penetrate firewalls, they're being presented as a national security effort against adversaries like Russia, like China, like Iran, like North Korea. That's a convenient sort of presentation on the part of the NSA or the government. But in fact, these vulnerabilities can be used anywhere and against anybody. That's what you're saying, right?
That's correct. Yep, that's exactly right. The reason they allowed these weaknesses to exist is one of the reasons why the OPM got hacked, why you read about other hacks in the U.S. here. People, they're not fixing the problems. And when you don't fix the problems, you're leaving everybody vulnerable and exposed. And that's what they've been doing.
They don't fix the problems because they help create the problems?
Well, also they do that, but it's a point. They don't fix it because they then have this window that they don't want to close so they can look through all systems and see what people are doing.
Right. So they're scoping. They're able to examine wherever vulnerabilities exist. They don't close them even on, say, the OPM, the Office of Personnel and Management, a U.S. government agency, because it allows them, the intelligence agencies, to go in. And that makes the OPM vulnerable to others, either foreign governments or criminals or whoever.
Yeah, but it also adds another aspect. This is the next fear-mongering issue. It's now that we got hacked. You know, all these hacks, every time you get hacked, everybody beats the drums of cybersecurity. Well, if you're beating the drums of cybersecurity and you really want to do it, you fix the problems you know about. And they don't do that. But they'll leverage the weaknesses and the fact that people get hacked to drum up more support for more money. It's another way of fleecing the U.S. public of money.
Bill Binney, let me ask you, in the New York Times article, it refers to the source code. It's referenced, the quote, source code referenced in the New York Times article. The same code is the one that was stolen from the Equation Group by a hacking outfit that calls themselves the Shadow Brokers. Is it the same?
Well, I'm not sure. It probably is. But, you know, it depends on who the inside source gave it to. OK,
Bill Binney, let's talk about the fact that in the last couple months, as a not a small but a big issue in the election campaign has been the assertion by Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party that the Russian government is hacking. They're not only hacking into the DNC, which revealed that the DNC violated its own rules and tilted the election, the primary election for Hillary Clinton as against Bernie Sanders, but they're also asserting that the Russians are breaking into the voter registration and voter sources for different states. In other words, all things that have been hacked by Russia. Now, the FBI, the government, has never validated any of these assertions, but the media treats them as true. Talk about this now that we have the new revelation that there's an inside person who's hacking or revealing information from the NSA.
Well, that's another thing that I brought up at the time. I mean, it doesn't have to be somebody hacking in. It could be somebody like an NSA who already has all of their emails. You know, they could take them out. Somebody like that inside NSA could do a data pull off the storage that they've got there and pull those emails out and then take them outside and give them to, just like Snowden did, or this other person, whoever he is or she. So, I mean, they could have done. There were many possibilities, but it's very clear that anybody did that hacking, the network logs would have a record of everything they did when they hacked in. And that's a traceable thing going back through the network using things like TraceRoute, you know, and TraceWatch, programs like that, to be able to find out where. I mean, you can use TraceRoute and tell where a packet came from through the network, how many segments it went through, how long it took to go through each segment, and where you could trace it back through the network worldwide. So it's a matter of them going through the worldwide network logs and following that all the way through. It's something that could be easily proven. So if they've got that proof, they haven't submitted it to the public view, at least not yet.
How big of a deal is the arrest of the person who is the insider? How big of a deal is this going to be politically?
To me, it should be a really big political issue, because this is our government making us vulnerable, using those vulnerabilities when we get hacked and attacked to fleece us of money. And that's the whole idea of the military-industrial intelligence complex. That's what President Eisenhower warned us about, you know, in 1961 when he was leaving office. He warned us about that, and here we are. We're right in the middle of it, and it's happening today. So, I mean, the whole point is this should be – these are political lobbyists, and people have an interest to create, for example, a Cold War with the Russians. I mean, after all, if the big bad Russians are the enemy, obviously they're doing some really nasty stuff, so we have to have another Cold War. What that means is more trillions of dollars invested in those in Defense Department and military industrial complex and intelligence complex. So it adds to their bottom line. It's a way of defrauding us all of money, which is what they've been doing for a long time.
Bill Binney, one final question. The arrest, the announced arrest, the announcement in the New York Times that an NSA contractor has been arrested in the last few weeks. What do you think its impact will be on the possibility of Edward Snowden returning to the United States?
I don't personally. personally think that would have any effect on that, because I don't think he's going to be able to come back to this country for quite some time. Certainly not until we get a government with people in it that are willing to hold government responsible for all the crimes it's been committing. And get a government to whistleblowers, because they usually are people who raise problems. And so they're raising the problem so the government can fix it themselves, but instead they attack them. So, that's why these people are going this way. It's the only other alternative to get the word out. You know, if you try to raise the issues internally in the government, like I did and others, they attack you. They try to put you in jail. I mean, they fabricate evidence against you. It's really a criminal government we have now. So until we get a government that's going to be honest and democratic and follow the principles of the Constitution, there's no way he can come back.
Bill Binney, I want to talk to you about another subject now, again, related to the NSA and related to mass surveillance. Hundreds of millions of Yahoo email accounts have been scanned using a custom-made software program in order to comply with a classified demand from the U.S. government. What does this revelation teach us about the reach of the intelligence agencies like the NSA and FBI? And why did Yahoo collaborate?
I think it's just basically an extension of the PRISM program, but I think it's probably done under Executive Order 12333 because it is basically unconstitutional. So, you know, I think they're doing it under Executive Order 12333, which is where they do all the unconstitutional collection and analysis of data.
I mean, were you surprised by the revelation?
No, because their primary purpose of the intelligence agencies is to push as much work off onto the onto the ISPs and the internet service providers and the telephone companies to do as much work for them as they can until they ultimately reduce their workload. That's fundamentally what it's all about. And they pay them to do that. So, I mean, Yahoo was getting paid to do all that work and get that data. So, I mean, it's using the standard dictionary search type acquisition of information. Like, for example, the DHS list of, 377 words or something like that. They're looking for those words in the content of emails and chatter and so on. And so they just simply have Yahoo search the data. And when they find matches on those words at a certain threshold, they ship them over there. So, and the more they ship over, the more they get paid. So, hey, they're really happy to do it.
Google and Microsoft have said that they haven't engaged in anything like this, with Google saying that they also never received a request, this classified request from the NSA to search, scan their users' emails for these particular words or these codes or these symbols, whatever they are.
Well, I don't think I could believe that for a minute, simply because the NSL released on the Calix, the national security letter issued by the FBI to the Calix company in New York, asked for that kind of data, certain words and addresses and so on. And so, I wouldn't believe that for a minute. That's my point. They've asked for it before in secret. That's done under Executive Order 12333, by the way, also. Those NSLs. And they've been declared unconstitutional by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
So why do the companies keep going along with it? I mean, again, Yahoo acknowledges, although they're disputing some elements of the Reuters report at this point, they've just issued a statement, but Google and Microsoft said they haven't engaged in anything like this, as I said, and that they also said they never received a request. But why would a company go along with it? I mean, why? They're selling a product. They're getting people to sign up with a Gmail account or a Yahoo account or another email account of some type related to associated with their companies. People want to have security. And why would they then continue to go to Yahoo? Edward Snowden said he tweeted when the story broke, "Use Yahoo. They secretly scanned everything you ever wrote far beyond what law requires. Close your accounts today." Why do they do it?
Well, they do it for the money. I mean, I would say right up front, because it adds to their bottom line with very little effort. So, I mean, I would put it that way, but I think that's part of the motivation anyway. The other part is they think they're doing something for national security when, in fact, they're basically destroying the republic that we supposedly have. They don't seem to realize that, though. I would say, you know, Gmail is also scanned data. They do that, too, so... that's the problem that they're doing too. Then that's been advertised already. So I wouldn't. It's like doing the same thing for the government and getting extra money to do it.
How much money are we talking about? Do we have any idea?
I think the business records program, which is the one that they're talking about dealing with the companies, runs about $500 million a year for all the companies.
Right. So, but you think, in other words, it's a business decision. It's commercial. It's not about being intimidated by the government or wanting to collaborate with the government. In other words, they're just looking at it as a commercial enterprise.
Yeah, that's what business does, right? Get how to make money, how to have the next contract, keep the contracts going. Keep the business going, be profitable. That's the motivation by companies.
What concerns does this raise, Bill Binney, about the security of servers based in the United States? I saw a report from Ireland right now. The Irish commissioner, after the story, is making an investigation. How dependent are European email users on American servers, and what should this tell them?
I think if you looked at the worldwide network, about 80% of the capacity of the network goes through or into or through the U.S. So, and of course, they have companies that are involved around the world that provide servers around the world, handle people's data. And this is not just the U.S., you know, it's the Five Eyes plus about seven other European and other countries in the world who are collaborating, cooperating on this. So it's not just us. There's a whole bunch of people. So the whole point is that probably on the order, my estimate would be close to 90% of all of the data is dependent on those servers that are directly or indirectly controlled by the Five Eyes and other collaborating countries.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with William Binney, Bill Binney. He is an NSA whistleblower. Bill Binney, thanks so much. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Now we turn to Syria. We are joined from Germany by Syrian journalist and political analyst Kaveh Almasian. We are also joined from Paris by political writer Diana Johnstone. We're talking about the fact that the U.S. government has announced that it is suspending any cooperation with Russia in Syria. And in fact, yesterday there were high-level meetings in the Obama administration about whether the United States should begin the direct bombing campaign against Syrian Arab Army, that is the Syrian government positions. Welcome, Kaveh and Diana. Kaveh, let's start with you. What do you make of all of this?
First of all, I think the latest announcement by the U.S. Counterpart that they will help all kind of cooperation or coordination with the Russian counterpart is a little bit misleading. First of all, I don't think there was a real cooperation, at least on the military level on the ground in Syria. There were a lot of disagreements between the Russians and the Americans regarding the military situation in Syria, and the Americans were not able, or they were not interested in halting, in stopping the violence, especially in the city of Aleppo, knowing that the conditions of the Syrian government and the Russian side is very clear. First of all, Al-Nusra Front has no place, which is the former, which is the Al-Qaeda wing in Syria, has no place in the political process. But until the moment, the allies of the United States are supporting this terror group. And mainly, even the generals of the Americans know that the eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo is mainly controlled by Al-Nusra Front. Therefore, according to international law and even UN Security Council resolution regarding Syria, it is legal to internationally to bomb Al-Nusra Front headquarters, Al-Nusra Front positions in eastern side of Aleppo. But by bombing this group in eastern Aleppo, that means that this whole neighborhood will be under the control of the Syrian Arab Army, which is not in the interest of the Americans, not this moment and not in the future. For them, the status quo was some kind of positive thing for them, the partition of Aleppo between east and west, and trying to keep this area under the control of their proxies in Aleppo. But for the Russians and the Syrians, it's obvious that Aleppo is a red line, and they will liberate it at any cost. So the Americans were forced, I believe, to hold this cooperation because they feel that they are embarrassed in front of their allies, at least in the Middle East, and they're also embarrassed that their strategy is not working in Syria.
Diana Johnstone, you published an article in the Counterpunch website called Destroying Syria, a Joint Criminal Enterprise. You agree with Cavework on this?
Well, of course, I certainly do. But, it's clear the United States has a single objective all along, which is an objective that it's had for years and years and years, long before the Arab Spring, which is to get rid of the independent Arab nationalist government in Syria and, if possible, put in place some puppets who call themselves for democracy or something. That isn't working, so because they can't find the puppets, and so their strategy is simply to destroy Syria, and first of all to keep the war just going and going and going, and the offensive that the government is having to take back all of Aleppo is a way of ending the war, ending the killing. But the United States doesn't want to do that. They want to keep on going. And of course, they're not alone. That's the same objective that Israel has stated. Israel strategists have stated very clearly, and I cited my article, that they want, to keep the bad guys, meaning Arabs or anybody else, killing each other as long as possible. And of course, it's also in the interest of Saudi Arabia, which wants to spread its Wahhabite ideology. And so these powers have joined together to destroy the legitimate state of Syria. And that's what this is all about, and it's not about anything else.
Cavework, the Washington Post, in a story about the run-up to the meeting that was held in Washington yesterday about whether or not the move would be made to carry out military strikes against the Syrian Arab Army. The primary force that's done the fighting, dying, bleeding in the struggle against ISIS and al-Qaeda and al-Nusra Front and the Army of Conquest, the Washington Post wrote, quote, "There's an increased mood in support of kinetic actions against the regime," one administration official said. The CIA and the joint staff have said that the fall of Aleppo would undermine America's counterterrorism goals in Syria. I mean, that's quite an admission, because President Obama, when he announced that there would be a bombing campaign in Syria after ISIL Daesh seized Mosul in 2014, he said the primary goal was to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL or ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. But here you have the fall of Aleppo to the sovereign government of Syria, the independent secular government in Syria that has been the main fighting force against ISIL. That would be something that would undermine America's counterterrorism goals in Syria. I mean, it's such doublespeak. Of course, it speaks directly to what you were saying, but comment on it again, if you would.
First of all, since the beginning, we were saying that this is a proxy war. So when the proxies fail, the masters intervene to continue the job. Now, all these proxy groups failed to overthrow President Bashar Assad and failed to create so-called Islamic State in Syria. So the Americans now threaten to intervene directly, either by bombing the American headquarters or maybe engaging in a ground military operation through their partners, maybe Turkey or Saudi Arabia. But in my opinion, I think this is all a media talk at the moment, and I totally rule out that the Americans might go into direct intervention in Syria. I mean, come on, before the Russians have their S-400 or the S-300 now to Syria, or the Hamamim air base and all the advanced equipment. And in 2013, in September, Obama couldn't bomb Syria. Even before these developments, Syria is much more stronger. The situation on the ground, the balance of power is totally in the interest of the Syrian army, and the Russians are strongly nowadays exist in Syria through their warplanes and their defense missile systems. And only a couple of days ago, they announced that they supplied Syria with S-300. So if the Americans will go in this challenge and bomb Syria, I think it will be a world war. I mean, this is not an exaggeration. I mean, we always listen to these conspiracy theories that World War III is very much is it's becoming closer and closer. But this is a world war. If all these powers fighting underground in Syria is not a world war, so then what is it? I mean, all regional countries are involved and international powers are involved indirectly. But today, if the Americans decide to intervene directly, I don't think this will pass without an answer by the Russians or without an answer by the Iranians, at least, you know.
Tavork, what you say makes a lot of sense, but that also requires rationality. Diana Johnston, go ahead, jump in if you would.
Well, I hope my Syrian colleague is right, but I'm more pessimistic. You see, the Syrian army has been fighting all of these forces very courageously and for 5 years. The army is necessarily tired. Notice that when Mrs. Merkel tells all the Syrians they can come to Germany, that's largely an invitation to young men who otherwise might go into the army. It's that is also a way to weaken the army by draining Syria of its young men, because you notice that most of the so-called refugees are young men, not families, but young men. So everything is done to weaken the Syrian army, and that means that when it goes into to a military battle to naturally to save its own forces, it has to use air power. So that is when it becomes an air battle. And you see, the United States has already bombed Syrian soldiers, killing over 60 and wounding 100, and then saying, "Oh dear me, we didn't know we were doing that," which I don't think any sane person can believe for a minute. So that was already showing the direction that they're going. Now, ISIS has endless foot soldiers coming from all over the world because they're worked up in some sort of fanatic religious, I don't know what, but, you know, so you have all these other soldiers coming in, armed by the United States, which is now going to give them weapons to shoot down planes, because the U.S. doesn't want to send in foot soldiers. That's the policy now. The United States wants to wreck the rest of the world and stay over from a safe distance, either by drones, and they need foot soldiers. And that's why they like these fanatics, because these fanatic Islamists are the foot soldiers for their war to overthrow Syria.
Tavork, I was part of and helped organize the anti-war movement here during the Iraq invasion. We had hundreds of thousands of people came out into the streets. Of course, the invasion went forward, the occupation went forward. But the whole experience made it very, very hard for American political leaders now to promise that they would send large numbers of American troops anywhere in the Middle East. Certainly, there's a restraint on American power as a consequence of all of this. You're doubtful that the United States will take the actions that the Pentagon seems to want to take, which would be the direct military assault against the Syrian Arab Army. And of course, both of you have noted the fact that if the U.S. bombs the Syrian Arab Army or Russia, the possibility of an even wider conflagration truly, truly does exist. But on the other hand, the Pentagon is extremely frustrated, both in the recent vice presidential debate here in the United States, the only vice presidential debate, not that we care about them as people so much, Kane or Mike Pence, but both of them said that they supported the creation of a so-called humanitarian zone in Syria. Hillary Clinton seems to be much more willing to go to war in Syria, a wider war than Obama has been. He's been a voice of restraint in some limited way. Do you rule out, Tavork, that this could even get bigger, even though, of course, as you pointed out, the dangers of a third world war are right there?
Actually, a few days ago, when President of the Joint Staff and the Defense Minister of United States were asked by some of the congressmen that can we make a safe zone or no-fly zone in Syria, they said that means we are going for a direct confrontation with Russia, and we are not going to make. I'm not going to make that decision. I quote. So maybe the words in the media are different than the actions on the ground, but I'm I'm speaking logically today, I know that the rationality doesn't really exist and always in the American administration or the Pentagon, but the war in Syria means that the end of the American empire in the Middle East. Today, this is not a joke anymore. They are national and transnational and regional powers in the region are opposing this American imperialist project in the Middle East, and they will be directly involved. So does America tolerate the deaths or the sacrifice of thousands of its soldiers on the soil, on the Syrian soil? I doubt it, but that doesn't mean that the Americans might not take this step. If they do it, that's a total defeat for their strategy in the Middle East, because the last 5 to 6 years, Obama was drawing his strategy on non-direct intervention, like in Libya, through some NATO troops, then the proxies underground occupy the facilities, the government facilities. Then in Syria, it's the same strategy. But if the Americans dare to intervene in Syria, I think it will be an all-out war between the Russians and the Americans on one hand, and also the Iranians and the Saudis on the second hand. That means in hell, you know. Maybe I want to believe that it's not coming, but maybe it would. I don't know. I just don't have the right answer for it.
Yeah, Diana Johnstone, I went to Iraq in 1990, right before the first Gulf War, and I met with the so-called Western hostages who were there. And all of them said, oh, there's not going to be a war. It doesn't make any sense. The Saddam Hussein government is really friendly to the West and et cetera. In other words, they came up with all the logical reasons. And I said at that time to them, you know, the U.S. doesn't send 450,000 troops to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia in order to negotiate. That's for war. And of course, the war did come and all the subsequent destruction. But now we're in a situation where, as Kvorak said, and as both of us have also mentioned, there is a constraint. There is a limitation on the U.S. The U.S. is frustrated. The empire said Assad must go, and Assad instead has gotten stronger with international support. So now they're in this sort of conundrum. They don't know what to do. But as Donald Rumsfeld said during the George W. Bush administration, when you have a problem that you can't solve, the goal is to expand the problem. I mean, John F. Kennedy called the U.S. military mad in terms of its orientation towards the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have about 90 seconds left. I know you can't predict the future, but try.
The United States is sick with an arrogance that is difficult for people elsewhere to understand. They have convinced themselves that once they start something, they mustn't lose, or they will lose their credibility, and they have to show that they can do what they said they could do. The Russians have done everything to try to save face to the Americans, to let them back out politely. They did that over the chemical weapons in 2014, and Obama went along with that, and he's been violently criticized by the war lobby, by the Israeli lobby ever since, because the war lobby is in control, and their attitude is that the United States cannot lose once it gets involved. And the Russians have tried to save them from this, but they show no willingness to make any kind of compromise.
Okay, that was Diana Johnstone. We've been talking to her from Paris, and also we've been talking with Kvorak Almasyan he's a Syrian journalist in Germany. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and World Bank begin their annual meetings in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. But this year, an atmosphere of gloom hangs over them as opposition to globalization rises. And is there an international vision of a future without neoliberal capitalism? Is it possible? We are joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Walter Smolarek, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The IMF and World Bank are holding their yearly meetings in Washington starting tomorrow. It's being held in a climate of fear over the global economy. Christine Lagarde, the IMF managing director, said, the global economy is weak and fragile. Those are her words. Why is it weak? Why is it fragile?
Well, I think there are two pieces to that puzzle. I mean, on the one hand, in the advanced, quote unquote, industrialized countries in the West, you have a situation where the economy has never really fully recovered from the Great Recession of 2007, 2008. There have been many different iterations of central bank life support that have been pursued in order to revive the rates of profit that corporations find acceptable. But these have been temporary fixes that hasn't really gotten the economy humming to the degree that it once was, you know, prior to the crisis. There's been negative to zero interest rates in almost all of the major countries. There's quantitative easing in the Eurozone. In the United States, there's not quantitative easing anymore. There's, you know, potentially a very, very minor rate hike in the horizon. But there's still extremely accommodative monetary policy that has been unable to stimulate growth. So that's one hand. On the other hand, the economies that had been the engines of what global growth had been going on in the post-crisis years, primarily the BRICS countries, other quote-unquote emerging markets, they've had a very rough few years. One major cause of it has been the extremely low commodity prices. There was sort of a super cycle, if you will, that led to very high oil prices and minerals and all sorts of exports that have now reach the other end of the cycle where they're at very low levels. And this has had the effect not only of harming growth rates and employment rates, but also affecting the balance sheets of these governments, making their credit rating poorer, and of course, all the other economic problems that go with that.
Right. We had the 2007-2008 economic recession. That recession, or Great Recession, was caused by the Wall Street banks, first and foremost. It was caused by a bubble in the housing market. Now we have a bubble in the stock market. The stocks have tripled in value since 2009 when Obama came in. They were about 6,600. Now it's over 18,000, perhaps 19,000. You have a situation where capital keeps flowing to wherever the banks or the governments allow different entities within the capitalist corporate establishment or banking establishment to have access to easy credit. Easy credit is then used for speculative purposes. Meanwhile, at the bottom, and the bottom isn't just the very bottom, the bottom includes big, big parts of society. For working class families, not only here, but all around the world, and as you said, in BRICS countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, emerging, major emerging markets, there's been really no economic relief at all. And in fact, there's economic stagnation, there's low wages, there's growing poverty. The IMF doesn't have any program for working class families. When they talk about weak and fragile, they're talking about what's happening at the top, right?
Yeah, of course. And the people at the top do everything in their power to pass that pain along down to the people at the bottom so that they feel as little as possible, or in fact, even benefit in some circumstances from the crisis where all of the weight falls on poor and working people. We saw that, of course, during the bank bailouts, right? And in fact, for some banks, the Great Recession was great because they got to consume all of their competitors, right? Their competitors went effectively bankrupt, and with the help of the U.S. government, they were able to, this is like Bank of America, for instance, Wells Fargo, they were able to acquire their creditors at their competitors at fire sale rate.
Right. Bear Stearns went down, Lehman Brothers, Wachovia. These are very, very, very big banks, and now they're just a part of even bigger banks, banks that are too big to fail, the bankers too big to jail. Again, yes, there's been what happened with the recession and what happens with all of the recessions is at the end of the recession, there's the so-called economic recovery, meaning the banks aren't in danger right now. They have stabilized. The basic corporate entities have stabilized. The auto companies that were essentially bankrupt, they too were bailed out. But part of the bailout terms are that the working class folks always have to take a cut. In the case of auto, for instance, the contracts with the United Auto Workers were just ripped up by the federal government. And even though it was a contract, contracts are supposed to be binding. It's the law. But because it was a contract with a workers organization, a union, it was ripped up. And the starting wage of auto workers went down to like $12, $13, $14 an hour. And on that basis, the U.S. auto industry stabilized. I mean, talk about what it would take really in order for the recovery to reach the masses of people who, for right now, it's not reaching.
Well, I think that's primarily a political question rather than an economic question, because, of course, there's vast wealth in society. I mean, even though growth isn't that fantastic right now, and even though, you know, it certainly feels that there's great scarcity in the economy, there's actually vast, vast abundance. It's just hoarded by a small clique of people, people at the very top, bankers, CEOs, top level executives. So it's primarily a political question as to who gets the spoils of that. And unions are an extremely important political vehicle to wage that struggle, right? So, you know, workers go to work, they create the wealth. And so unions are, you know, their goal is to recoup as much of that value, as much of that value created by labor as possible to labor. There is also, you know, the struggle in the streets. I mean, one of the main ways that the pain of the crisis was passed down to poor and working people is through austerity measures, through cuts to vital social programs, including education, health subsidies, LIHEAP, which is a heating subsidy program for low-income people. So, right, I mean, it's a political question. It's will people struggle in the streets to make sure that they pay for their crisis and not us?
I want to read to you Walter Smolarek from The Guardian. They wrote an article in January based on an Oxfam report, and I want to read part of it to you and let you quote, or let you comment on it. The vast and growing gap between rich and poor has been laid bare in a new Oxfam report showing that the 62 richest billionaires own as much wealth as the poorer half of the world's population. That would be about 3.5 billion people. That 62 people have the same amount of wealth. I mean, in other words, when you wonder why there are so many poor people, you can just say, well, the rich people have all the money. Continuing with the article, time to coincide with this week's gathering, this was last January, of many of the super rich at the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, the report calls for an urgent action to deal with the trend showing that 1% of the people own more wealth than the other 99% combined. I mean, this trend is a feature, a dominant feature of contemporary capitalism.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I mean, you can ask yourself just a logical question. I mean, do those 62 people work, I don't even know what number that would be, you know, 600 million times more than the other, or 60 million times more than the other 3 billion poor people in the world?
Of course, the answer is yes, they're that capable.
Right, and that creative and smart and hardworking. But no, of course, the wealth, in fact, doesn't come from those 60 people. It comes from the billions of people who go to work every day who actually create the products that are useful to people. And so much of the wealth of this tiny 1% is just entirely fictitious. It's all based on these, electronic numbers on a computer screen, right? There's these exotic financial instruments that banks come up with every year, 2 years, or many times a year, you know, whatever. They're always looking for these new instruments to be able to place bets, to leverage things, to turn $1 into $10. And it doesn't matter if it's actually based on anything that's produced. In fact, the point is that it can't be based on things that are produced because there's just simply not enough of it. And certainly those 3 billion people who live in deep poverty, crushing poverty, are not going to be able to buy all those products. So they just come up with these fictitious sources of profit.
Right. But it's also, in addition to the fiction, there is the nonfiction, there is the reality, the truth, that because they own the banks, because they own the biggest corporations, they are legally entitled to whatever the wealth is, whether it seems to be fictitious on a computer screen or not. That's tangible wealth. In other words, it's money.
Yeah, it's absolutely money. I mean, they, to one degree or another, could withdraw it, could spend it however they want. But it just, I mean, it begs the question, like, what are the types of priorities we have as a society? I mean, those 60 people can live extremely well, right? I'm sure they have many, many mansions and properties all over the world, many cars, private jets, helicopters. I mean, things that we can't even imagine. But we live in an economic system where, you know, there are choices that are made. There is planning that's done to one degree or another, right? I mean, it's not just this invisible hand of the market. There are choices made by individuals, by a relatively small number of individuals that determine whether or not you're one of the 3 billion poor people or one of the 60 unbelievably wealthy people.
Let's talk about the politics of the anti-globalization sentiment, because, again, as we said in the beginning, the IMF World Bank meetings here in Washington, D.C., there's a mood of gloom and doom over them because there is a rising tide of anti-globalization. The IMF managing director said the worst problem would be if the world turned away from economic integration meaning trade and so on. But that's not really what the issue is. In other words, the pro-globalization forces like Lagarde, the IMF managing director, she said, we can't go back to a system of protectionism. We have to have integration, meaning that the corporations can compete with each other without restrictions, without obstacles, without hindrance by other governments or either federal or local governments that put obstacles into their way or tariffs or protection measures. And that ultimately this will be good for people because people will get the products, the commodities that they choose to buy wherever they're produced. In other words, it's a global playing field. That's what they say. But on the opposition side, those on the left say it's not really about integration. It's about the corporatocracy. In other words, the absolute takeover of all things by corporate elites. And then on the right wing, you have another message, and the right wing is especially strong in Europe and getting stronger. It's also part of the Donald Trump message. Their message is, yes, globalization is benefiting the elites. The problem is integration, because integration means foreigners can come to our country. And of course, there are 60 million people on the move right now, people who have been made into refugees because of wars or occupation or famine, but particularly because of unemployment, because of poverty. So there's a competing sort of narrative about which way to go forward. If we're against globalization, does it mean we're against integration? Does globalization mean nationalism? Or what's the left wing sort of answer to the right wing opposition to globalization? Because if the left does not have an answer, does not have a response, does not have the organization of the people, including the people who are being hit very hard, then they're fair game for right-wing and even fascist forces.
Well, the right-wing narrative about globalization really turns reality on its head, because what the IMF and World Bank and these neoliberal trade agreements like the TPP are really aimed at doing is not allowing foreign forces to come in and dominate the United States or any other Western country. It's really about the opposite. It's about giving Western corporations, Western capital, the Western big banks, the ability to go anywhere they want in the world, uninhibited, by regulations, by tariffs, you know, whatever instrument that governments could use, and being able to exploit those countries' labor, those countries' resources, their markets to an uninhibited extreme degree. So the IMF, the World Bank, they're part of an architecture of international power, which is dominated by the United States, right? I mean, the World Bank is always led by an American. The IMF is always led by a European. I mean, not a very democratic thing, clearly a way to impose hegemony. And so we think that, you know, those of us on the left who are critics of quote unquote globalization or of neoliberal globalization, that the only way that we can possibly break this architecture of power is by uniting with our sisters and brothers in other countries who are suffering, honestly suffering much worse than the workers here in the United States are from these devastating agreements. And through that unity, through that joint struggle, by refusing to be divided, which is the key political strategy that comes along with any of these efforts to control the world, that's when we're really powerful and able to do something about this.
You mentioned BRICS before. That's the alliance between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Brazil, of course, has had the overthrow, the coup d'etat against the Workers' Party government. They've been replaced by the Temer government, which is a right-wing, pro-neoliberal government. So we don't know how that will impact on BRICS. But I want to talk about BRICS, or the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, the bank China started, really as a rival, so that the IMF wasn't the dominant lending institution in the world along with the Western banks. The IMF and the World Bank and the UN were the three pillars of the post-World War II world order that was created under really the domination of the United States. The IMF, even if it's led by a European, it's an American institution. It's American power. It's the American post-World War II plan. Yes, the Americans created this post-World War II plan, but it seems now that that plan, that world order, is in fact coming undone. We can expect a period, in fact, of economic and political instability. Again, we're not in recession, except millions, hundreds of millions of people feel that they're in recession, maybe billions, I would say. But another recession will be coming. We don't know when. In the next 2 minutes, try to sort of look forward, and what do you, Walter Smolarek, anticipate given the fact that the world order, including this kind of globalization project under the domination of IMF, World Bank, and those kind of economic models, is in fact coming apart.
Yeah, I think that accounts for a lot of the gloom that the IMF and World Bank officials are feeling this week as they meet. I think that there's some difficulty in terms of the construction of an alternative set of global institutions. You know, it seemed maybe much more likely a year or two ago for political reasons, not for economic reasons, the economic potential of the BRICS, of other emerging markets, that still certainly does exist, even if they're going through a difficult period because of commodity prices. But with the overthrow of the Workers' Party government in Brazil, with other political developments, you know, India moving much closer to the United States under Prime Minister Modi, it seems that the political will for it might be fading a little bit. However, if we look forward, if we think that, well, you know, it's been about 10 years since the last economic crisis, which means we're due for another one, I think it's entirely reasonable to think that we're looking at a very stormy period of world politics and international diplomacy going forward, where those orientations might shift. I mean, you know, China obviously has very serious structural economic problems. They probably will try to keep those under wraps until the Party Congress in September 2017. So there might be a suppression of these tensions for the next, you know, year or so, but they can only be suppressed for so long.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Walter Smolarek about the IMF World Bank meetings here in Washington, D.C. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.